Oyez, oyez, Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, City of Austin, is now in session.
Good morning, y'all can be seated, thank you. Good morning, welcome to the Third Court of Appeals, Justice Crump, Justice Ellis, and I welcome you. This morning, we're going to be hearing from cause number 0324754CV, Smith versus Ranger Excavating LP. If I could have counsels introduce themselves for the record, please.
Your Honor, Fraser Holmes on behalf of appellant Peter Smith.
And Andrew Gould also on behalf of appellant Peter Smith.
Thank you.
Your Honor, Wade Crosno on behalf of the appellee Ranger Excavating.
Tasha Barnes also on behalf of the appellee Ranger Excavating.
All right, welcome. Y'all can be seated. Thank you very much. As you know, I'm assuming that on behalf of Mr. Smith, you'll be opening with 15 minutes, and then we'll hear from the appellee for 20, and then we'll hear from a rebuttal from Mr. Smith for 5. You also know that we are broadcasting this on our YouTube channel. Gussy up your hair and contact all your family members. You'll be able to see this later, in front of the fireplace with your children and pups and things, and brag on yourself and your clients. But with that, Smith ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is Ranger ready to proceed today?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much. Then, Mr. Smith, you may take over the podium. Oh, and also, as you know, the red, yellow, and green is kind of easy to understand. The yellow is a 2-minute warning, so you'll need to wrap up at that point. Yes, sir.
Good morning, and may it please the court.
Mr. Holmes, before you get started, I have a quick question
yes,
for
ma'am.
You. So the trial court severed your claims against Ranger into a separate cause number.
Yes, ma'am.
And then, but you're appealing from a different cause number today, is that correct?
I think we are appealing from the main case. I think that is correct.
So you were severed into 248547, and the cause number you're appealing today is 222463. So setting aside the question of whether a summary judgment is properly before us, should White Construction be a party to this appeal? And what happened to White Construction?
So, Your Honor, my understanding is that White Construction has settled. Mr. Smith and White Construction have settled. And so that dispute between those two parties, as I understand it, has been resolved.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so there's no need for White Management to be here today for this proceeding.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
All right. You may proceed.
May it please the court.
Yes.
The trial court's order granting Ranger's partial motion for hybrid motion for summary judgment should be reversed for 3 reasons. First, the trial court granted summary judgment on Mr. Smith's ordinary negligence claim based on Ranger's sole argument that the claim sounded in premises liability. But that argument is contrary to black letter law and contradicted by Ranger's repeated declamations of control over the premises. Second, even if this court considers that Mr. Smith's claim properly sounds in premises liability, summary judgment was nevertheless improper because there are fact issues on each of the elements of Mr. Smith's premises liability claim. And third, the trial court's grant of summary judgment on Mr. Smith's gross negligence claim cannot be supported because a scintilla of evidence supports both the objective and subjective prong of that claim. For all those reasons, the trial court's judgment below should be reversed. Your Honors, I largely intend to rest on my briefing on the third element, the gross negligence element. I anticipate the argument will mainly focus on the first issue and a little bit also on the second. So begin with the first issue about Mr. Smith's claim for ordinary negligence.
And Can I sidetrack you a little
sure.
bit? I want to kind of go to the premises liability thing first,
sure.
if I can.
Sure.
Is your client's position on the premises, let's focus there since that's what the trial court focused on. Is it your client's position that the issue of right of control, because that's where y'all's fight seems to be on the premises issue, is that a question of fact, which is kind of your argument, or is that a question of law that we can just decide without sending it to the jury.
So the issue of whether Ranger controlled the premises is an issue of fact. But when Ranger has made judicial admissions stating that it did not have control over the property, what it has declaimed is any argument it could have that Mr. Smith's sole claim sounds in premises liability. And so the fact that there is a fact question there does not change the analysis that the proper claim going forward is ordinary negligence. Because Mr. Smith's, the control of the premises at the time of the question is the antecedent question and is not the nature of the injury. And on that point, I want to kind of start with where we agree, and I'm taking directly from Ranger's appellee brief. This is at page 14. Ranger says, it is undisputed that Ranger constructed the ramp. If the ramp posed a dangerous condition, Ranger can be liable for the condition, regardless of whether it had control of the premises at the time of the injury. We agree with that assessment entirely. What the parties dispute is, what is the nature of that liability? Does it sound in ordinary negligence, or does it sound in premises liability? Now, the good news for this court is precedent is very clear. The Texas Supreme Court has said that continuing liability sounds in ordinary negligence. So in Strakos, for instance, the court held that contractors could be liable for creating the danger even after they relinquished control. Strakos is an ordinary negligence case, notwithstanding that the plaintiff suffered a premises defect type injury. And the court makes it even more clear in Occidental, page 647 of that opinion. It says, the contractor's duties to a plaintiff are thus tied not only to its control of the premises, but also to the quality of its contracted work, whether Ranger created a dangerous condition in the first place. This latter duty may be judged under ordinary negligence principles even after the contractor has left the premises. And so again, that there is a dispute between the parties about what this continuing liability is, but there's no dispute in the case law. The case law is clear that this continuing liability that Ranger holds is in general negligence. Now, Ranger gets to the other result by saying, well, the first thing you need to look at is you need to look at the nature of Mr. Smith's injury. But that conclusion is wrong for two reasons. The first reason is it is a second step of a two-step inquiry. And the first step of that inquiry is determining, did the independent contractor have control at the time of the injury? And the reason why control is the first question is because control determines the duty.
So I have a question about that.
Yes, ma'am, just tell us.
How do you distinguish United Scaffolding in terms of your argument that it's not a premises liability claim?
So in United Scaffolding, the dispositive difference is the defendant in United Scaffolding did not declaim control.
I figured your answer would be control.
Right. So in United Scaffolding, the court approaches everything from the perspective that the defendant actually had control of the premises. But Ranger has specifically declaimed six times that it did not have control. And so under its own argument, United Scaffolding is not applicable in this circumstance.
So a follow-up from that. So if you're arguing that this is that Ranger had no control of the premises, how can Ranger have a duty to fix a condition they no longer had control over?
Right. So Ranger has a duty to fix a condition even when it doesn't have control because it created the unreasonably dangerous condition in the first place. That's Strakos. So the rule used to be, Justice Ellis, that if once an independent contractor's work was accepted by the premises owner, then all liability shifted to the premises owner for subsequent defects. That was called the assumed work doctrine. The Supreme Court in Strakos says that's not really a workable rule anymore because it makes negligence turn on things like arbitrary things like when was the contract signed? And so instead, what we're going to do going forward is, and this was from 1962, so this has been the case for a long time, What we're going to do going forward is we are going to evaluate an independent contractor's liability under principles akin to product manufacturers. And that's the default presumption, is that they are held to ordinary negligence standards because of their creation of a dangerous condition. Now, that circumstance changes a little if, in addition to this liability, they also had control of the premises. Because if the independent contractor also had control of the premises, they also owe premises liabilities, including to keep the conditions on the property unreasonably safe, or reasonably safe from unreasonably dangerous conditions. Now, that's there's nothing inherently wrong with there being two, and so a breach of each of those duties could lead to liability under each of those series. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, except the Texas Supreme Court has told us in these circumstances you can have a general negligence claim, you can have a premises liability claim, but you can't have both. And so when there are these two competing duties, the Texas Supreme Court says we have to look at the injury because that's how we know which of these claims can go to the jury. But we don't have that problem here because Ranger has admitted it did not have control over the premises at the time. And so its sole duty, its only duty to Mr. Smith, arises in its duty to use reasonable care to avoid creating an unreasonably dangerous condition. And the Supreme Court held in Strakos, it reaffirmed in Occidental, it reaffirmed in Eagle Ridge. That negligence sounds in ordinary, that liability sounds in ordinary negligence principles.
So are you saying that if you're in the position of Ranger and you've got a plaintiff that's making an argument against you in their pleadings, maybe they're arguing in the alternative a claim for negligence and premises, and they respond in turn with defenses of both, that say defending themselves against negligence and then defending themselves against your premises, that even though they're saying two different things about control, that that constitutes a judicial admission that gets them in conflict, that they can't argue against both of your allegations because they get themselves into a conflict by making judicial admissions about control. Do you understand what I'm saying? That they're having to make alternative arguments. They can't pick and choose because you've put them in kind of a catch-22.
I don't know that I agree with that, Your Honor, because of the status of White Construction as a co-defendant.
Mm-hmm.
And so we in the initial pleadings, the allegations that sound in premises liability are applicable to White Construction as the owner of the premises. And so as our complaint is currently constructed, this is an ordinary negligence claim against Ranger. Right, irrespective of the whatever liability we may have against White Construction. And so there's no catch-22 from Ranger's perspective. I think it looks like that now because of the nature of Ranger's presentation of summary judgment, where Ranger says this has to be a premises liability claim because the injury sounds in premises, and we didn't have control, so it can't be a premises liability claim. Well, in that context, with us responding to summary judgment, our initial argument, which we think is the correct statement of the law, is this is an ordinary negligence claim, so that summary judgment is improper. But we also have to address the consideration that maybe this court considers it should be held in premises liability. And in those circumstances, the dispute over control is where it's relevant. And we think there is a genuine dispute of material fact to control given the holdings in United Scaffolding, given the holdings in Olivo and similar cases like that. So I would add too, just very briefly, on the premises liability. Ranger, there are four elements, as you know, this court is aware. Ranger really only attacks the middle two. It says that the ramp was not unreasonably conditious. The ramp was not unreasonably dangerous as a matter of law, and that also it owes no duty to warn Mr. Smith because of the open and notorious nature of the injury. So start with the unreasonably dangerous argument. Ranger's only argument for that is it's not unreasonably dangerous because the dirt was in a natural position, and the Supreme Court has held in MO Dental, dirt in its natural condition is not unreasonably dangerous as a matter of law. That ignores that the dirt was not in its natural condition. The dirt was moved to compose a ramp done by Ranger. This was not a circumstance where Mr. Smith was walking around an undeveloped field and slipped on a rock. The natural condition of the dirt was the result of Ranger's artificial action. It was also compounded by the fact that this surface is traversed by vehicles, by pedestrians, even though it shouldn't be traversed by pedestrians. And so if that was a natural occurring substance at the beginning, which we dispute, it has since been moved by significant movement by trucks through.
What could Ranger have done to have made it safe or warned Smith? Did it need to have signage? Did it need to have compression? Did it need to have pavement? Did it need to have flagmen? What did it need to do to make it safe?
I think it needed to do two things. The first thing it needed to do was it needed to make sure that there was some way to access the lower level of the excavation without having to take the ramp. So it was responsible for building stairs or a ladder.
Is that contractual?
It is. It's both contractual. It also sounds in the OSHA regulations.
Where is it in the contract?
So that's in section 19.1. That's at 104 in the record. What the contract says is that a ranger is responsible for complying with all laws and regulations, including those held by OSHA. I would note, too, though, Chief Justice Byrne, that what 19.1 goes on to say is those are minimum safety standards. That is the bare minimum that Ranger has to meet in order to under its contractual obligations. I also think, Chief Justice Byrne, that its duty to create an alternate method of ingress is implicit in its reasonable duty to avoid creating a dangerous condition.
So is there anywhere in the contract that says, Ranger, you are to install stairs?
Not in specifically those words.
Okay.
No.
And who did install stairs a few weeks later?
My understand—I don't think the record is clear on that.
Okay.
My understanding is that White did, but I—that's just my understanding based on my review of the record. I don't know that that's necessarily.
And
the case.
Where in the record, if anywhere, is there any evidence after Gibson's affidavit was excluded about OSHA violation as it relates to the dirt ramp?
So I don't know that there's evidence, but what we're the reliance there is on case law that this is Louisiana Pacific saying that that the lack of safety regulations informs these negligence questions.
Say that one more time. I didn't understand your answer. So if the Gibson affidavit was properly excluded, what evidence is there of an OSHA violation as it relates to the dirt ramp?
Oh, so, Your Honor, we have photographic evidence of the ramp at the time. There's no stairs of the ramp at the time.
I understand that, but what evidence? I know that there's a photograph of the dirt ramp, but what evidence is there of an OSHA violation of the dirt ramp if Gibson's affidavit is out?
I don't know that there is evidence in the record for that, but happy to supplement on that.
I have a follow-up question
yes,
to that. Just is there, or can you direct us to anywhere in the record where we would find any evidence that Ranger knew or should have known that the loose rocks were in fact problematic?
Right. So I think the evidence there, I think that's where I'm largely relying on Louisiana Pacific. I think the evidence there is Ranger was aware that these vehicular use, that these ramps were intended for vehicular use. They were aware that they were being traversed by pedestrians, and they were aware that pedestrians traversing those ramps created a risk. That's from Mr. Blase's testimony. I think it's pronounced Blase. I've heard it pronounced Blaze, Mr. Blase. It's up in the 90s of the record, 91 to 93, I think.
And I know that you're out of time, but I have a couple of questions. What exactly, in your opinion, is the unreasonable dangerous condition here? The steepness of the ramp, the loose gravel, the fact there were no stairs, some sort of combination of all of these?
Some sort of combination of all of those. It is mainly the unreasonably dangerous condition is the creation of the excavation process where the only way that Mr. Smith could go down was descending this ramp, right? So it is and ensuring that ramp is not ensuring that ramp was unreasonably dangerous.
So weren't all those conditions open and obvious?
I think there's a genuine issue there because of, at the very least, because of Mr. Smith's continued walking down the ramp, and Mr. Blase's testimony that where there is no other mode of ingress, it is very reasonable for pedestrians to use those ramps, even though they are primarily used by vehicular traffic.
And my last question, I promise. Yeah. Can the trial court take judicial notice of OSHA regulations?
Uh, I, I think it can, but Your Honor, my main point behind the OSHA regulations there are that they inform the standard of care more than anything else, and that they inform Ranger's knowledge of the dangerousness conditions.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you. We'll hear more from you in rebuttal, I'm sure. Counsel. Thank you. Sorry. All right. Let's hear from the appellee.
May it please the court, counsel. It's been a while since I've argued here. It's good to be back in this courtroom, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, all of you, about this case. I first want to just briefly summarize our main 2 points, and then I'm going to go straight into addressing the arguments that counsel made here and some of the questions the court asked.
And I specifically want you to talk about the judicial admission
sure.
issue. Yes, sir.
I thought you might. So the first point I want to make is that under controlling Texas Supreme Court precedent, plaintiff's claim does sound exclusively in premises defect rather than negligence because the injury was caused by an alleged condition of the premises rather than any ongoing contemporaneous act of negligence. And the control issue doesn't make any difference on that for the reasons I'll explain in a moment. Second, the plaintiff's premises defect claim fails because Ranger owed no duty to warn of an open and obvious condition and one that Mr. Smith was actually aware of, which was the presence of loose rocks and dirt on a dirt ramp he had regularly walked down and driven down for 6 weeks before the date of this accident. Now, I want to go directly to the Chief Justice's question about right of control and its relevance here. If you look at the Texas Supreme Court's decision in United Scaffolding versus Levine, they first addressed this issue about the nature of the injury. Did it arise from a premises condition, or did it arise from a negligent activity? And it went through that in depth. So that's the first step here. And then second of all, the court came to the control issue, and it's not 100% clear to me when you read through the opinion whether they were just addressing the Court of Appeals and the plaintiff's argument that control was relevant. They seem to suggest that it is relevant to determining the nature of the claim. So I'll address it here. But the question the court had asked is whether that is a question of fact or law. And on the right of control, I think it can be a question of fact when you're talking about actual control. But when you're talking about contractual right of control, that is a question of law. And that's what the plaintiffs themselves have focused on in their trial court and in their briefing. They want to say that we admitted lack of control by posing a defense to the elements of one of their claims. But at the same time, they want to overlook the fact that they alleged in the trial court repeatedly that you know, we had installed this ramp, but we still had to take it down at the end of the project. They say we had a daily duty to inspect this ramp, and that was ongoing by a competent person. So these are their allegations, and that, and I don't know about the daily part, but there is a provision in the contract that talks about a requirement of providing a competent person, competent OSHA person at the work site for the subcontracted work to review the conditions and take actions to correct them. So,
and counsel, one of the arguments that they raise in their briefing is, aren't we as the appellate court in reviewing the facts to look at those in the lens most favorable to them versus most favorable to the movement in the trial court below? And so if they're raising facts to compete with your facts related to control, aren't we supposed to give them the nod in appellate review?
Well, we are talking here about what they've actually alleged and not just the facts, and we're talking about what's in the contract. So I don't think you construe contractual terms in one party's favor or another. So
because that's a matter of law.
That's a question of law.
Understood.
So counsel has also argued that the Texas Supreme Court said in Stratcos and Occidental and some other opinions that once a contractor relinquishes control, then it becomes a negligence claim, even if it's for a dangerous condition on the premises. The contractors in those cases that they're relying on had all completed work on the project and were gone completely. And so there's a difference between that and what you have here, which is we install the ramp, and we have to take it out later, and we have various other tasks we've got to perform out there too.
And what are the other tasks? I know you have to take the ramp out later. Where you've installed it? What other phases of tasks does Ranger have?
Pardon me, I don't have those memorized, but they are on page 110 of the contract, and they involve some grading and various other tasks. I think I've got one right here.
Are they grading of the ramp to continue to make it safe or level?
Pardon me,
certainly.
Apologies for the delay. So the contract says on page 110 of the clerk's record that the scope of work includes, in addition to the ramp work, remove parking lot and clear site within the limits of construction, remove abandoned utilities, bench back excavation at a 1:1 slope, building pad, then it talks about the ramp installation and removal, and then it goes on to list various other things at this particular site. So it wasn't just building the ramp and then taking it down. And again,
so is it your client's position that it was your client's responsibility to put in the stairway?
No, it is not, and the contract does not require that. And the fact that White Construction did it and that there's no evidence that we did it indicates that it was not our responsibility. And the court is correct that on the affidavit of Mr. Gibson was struck that detailed the alleged OSHA violations, but in particular on the installing stairs, that was not part of our contract and not part of our scope of work.
In your opinion, is the failure to comply with OSHA regulations some evidence of negligence or that there was a dangerous condition?
So I don't think I don't think so, because there is no evidence in the expert affidavit, which was struck, and so I don't think there's evidence of an OSHA violation here. And our argument on the...
Just generally, not just in this, is the failure to comply with OSHA regulations, generally, do you think that would be some evidence?
We get into this issue in some cases about whether OSHA sets the standard, and we always have the argument that they don't, and then the other side always says, oh yes, they do. I don't think so, but they are not intended to set the standard of care, and so I think the answer to that question is no. Now, there was a statement made during counsel's argument that in United Scaffolding, the defendant did not disclaim control, and I disagree with that statement. If you look at page 475 of the United Scaffolding opinion, and then also footnote 2, the plaintiff was making the same sort of argument that, hey, the defendant here denied control in the trial court and said they weren't even there at the accident site on the date of the accident. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument and said, well, we've got to look at what's in the contract, and the contract reflects a ongoing duty to inspect the scaffolding at issue. So that's control. Plaintiff is also alleging control, and we're not going to say that just because the defendant denied an element of a claim in the trial court that that is dispositive on the issue about.
But that one went to jury, didn't it?
That one did go to the jury, yes. Okay. But I don't know that that would make a difference here.
May I ask about the open and obvious question that we discussed earlier?
Yes.
As I understand, Ranger's primary defense is that they had no duty and that the ramp was open and obvious and that Mr. Smith had passed through many times on foot and on vehicle. I think I'm understanding that the plaintiff, Mr. Smith, appellant now, is suggesting that there's no evidence that he knew or should have known that the rocks became loose, causing him to fall. Can you direct the court to where in the record, if anywhere, there is evidence that he knew or should have known of this open and obvious condition?
So I think if you look in the clerk's record at Mr. Smith's deposition testimony, okay. And probably the most relevant parts are at between page 46 and 56 of the clerk's record.
Thank you.
That's where you would need to look. You might want to go back to clerk's record 37, because I think that's where he starts discussing. He'd been a superintendent on this job site. He was not someone who wandered in off the street and then walked down this ramp and fell. He'd been there for 6 weeks. He was the superintendent for the concrete subcontractor. He testified that he had walked down this exact ramp at least 6 times. He had driven down it too. So, and he testified that obviously this sort of, you know, ramp is incline with loose rocks and dirt, it obviously is a potential tripping hazard. So he admitted he knew. He also knew that he said he assumed that it was designed for vehicular traffic and equipment traffic and not for pedestrian use.
But it had been used.
It had, yes. And we're not denying that there was evidence that he had walked down it 6 times. I mean, that's part of our argument for why it was an open and obvious.
And others had as well, correct?
Others had as well. So, but it was, you could look at it and see it was a dirt ramp, and a dirt ramp that was.
But for the ramp, no one could get down into the pit, correct? Unless they jumped 12 feet.
Well, that's true, but they could. He testified that he usually drove down it in his truck, and the only reason he didn't that day was because his truck was parked a distance away from where he was, and he was right there at the ramp, so he figured, why not walk down it?
But aren't these all fact questions? I mean, as we start getting into testimony and whether or not someone should jump 12 feet or whether or not they became slippery overnight. I mean, isn't the jury entitled to answer those questions about open and obvious?
So on the duty issue, the Supreme Court has made it clear that there is no duty when it's open and obvious or the danger is otherwise known to the plaintiff. So that's a legal question. And here, our argument is that his testimony conclusively shows the lack of a duty. So you know, not only just objectively from an objective standpoint, when you look at a dirt ramp going down into an excavated hole where construction is being done, you would know that there's a danger of slipping and falling on it. His testimony indicates that he did in fact know about that, and so it's objectively open and obvious, and it's also subjectively known to him, and that equals no duty.
Do you dispute that there was no alternative means to walk through that area?
I think at the time of the accident, the record indicates that the stairs had not yet been built. The stairs that were the responsibility, we believe, of White Construction to build, and there's no evidence that it was our responsibility to build those. So
do you believe there was a responsibility to have stairs installed?
Well, I mean, they were installed, and let me back up and say this. So the OSHA regulation that they're relying on requires a stairwell for a trench excavation.
I don't think
I don't think that this qualifies as a trench excavation, and they haven't cited any authority or provided any expert testimony that hasn't been struck that it did involve a trench excavation.
Well, I'll ask you the same question that I asked before. Can the trial court take judicial notice of OSHA regulations?
I think the court could, but it's a question then of does that provide the standard of care? And really here we're focusing on the duty issues and also the unreason, which is turns on the open and obviousness and the subjective awareness. And then we're focusing on whether this was an unreasonably dangerous condition. And I don't think those OSHA regulations go to that issue. And on that subject, I would like to just address briefly, the Supreme Court has said in MO Dental Lab decision in 2004 and some prior cases that when you have a naturally occurring condition, such as mud in that case, and in some of the other cases they cite in that decision involved literally dirt and rocks in a rodeo arena, and a horse kicked up a rock and it hit someone in the eye. And the Supreme Court has said consistently that those sort of naturally occurring conditions are not unreasonably dangerous as a matter of law. Dirt and rocks are naturally occurring conditions. The argument that's being made here is, well, you manipulated those to form a dirt ramp, but nothing about what we did changed the organic or chemical composition of the dirt and the rocks, or mixed it with something else to transform it into some other sort of substance, such as concrete or whatever. And you could have this same sort of dirt hill, for lack of a better word, in nature. And so I think this is still a naturally occurring condition, even if it was converted into a ramp here.
But I mean, those of us from the country are familiar with caliche roads and dirt roads that are maintained by our wonderful county and the like. And typically those require maintenance. And you'll have a caliche road and big trucks and things go over them, and then they become pitted and washed out, and you've got big holes, and you could almost lose a VW van in them. And then the county has to come back and put more dirt in, and then do water trucks, and then compact it again. I mean, are you saying that in this instance, when you've got big trucks that I assume have got like rock in the back of them and big equipment going down in the bottom of an excavated pit that's building a big building, that there's no obligation on a ramp that's a dirt ramp that could easily get the rocks pitted out. There's no obligation to maintain that ramp because those big trucks can make the rocks unsteady, move, slip, get big gutted holes from day to day. I mean, there's just no obligation. You can just let it sit out there for 6 weeks while Mr. Smith's working there and never look at it again.
Well, the record doesn't really reflect what sort of maintenance along those lines was done, but I think that gets into the issue of whether there was a breach rather than whether there was a duty in the first place. And you do have someone who was a, and I see my time is up, may I continue?
Please, and I do have one follow-up question.
Yeah, and please, we let them answer questions after the red.
Thank you. So you do have a superintendent who was out there for 6 weeks, had been up and down this ramp, and so it is open and obvious, and regardless of whether there was or was not an ongoing duty to come out there regularly, and this was designed for vehicular use and for big equipment use, so that sort of thing was going to happen. But I don't think that is directly relevant to the duty issue we're talking about, and you know, whether it was an unreasonably dangerous condition.
And very quickly, if we decide that this is a negligence claim and not a premises liability claim, do you believe that we are obligated to reverse and remand?
If it is a negligence claim, we really haven't. I think our no evidence motion did raise issues about no evidence of duty and breach with respect to the negligence issues. We really haven't pursued that particular argument on appeal. So I think in that instance, which we, you know, and we disagree that it's a negligence claim, we think it is a premises claim as a matter of law. I think you would have to reverse and send the negligence claim back, but there's also a gross negligence claim out there, and for the reasons we briefed, and I won't go into unless you want me to, that there's no evidence of the objective or subjective elements of that claim.
Thank you.
Just for the, I think it would help the court a lot to understand, then for the purpose of this appeal, are you all asking the court to analyze only the question about duty? I think that Smith suggests that you're not challenging the remaining elements of premises liability, at least.
Well, I think we are challenging two. One is the duty, and one is you have to have an unreasonably dangerous condition for a premises claim. And we are arguing that naturally occurring dirt and rocks are not an unreasonably dangerous condition.
Okay. So those two?
Those two.
Okay. Yes. So everybody agrees that the court could focus on those two issues?
With the threshold issue of whether this is a premises or negligence claim, which we say that it is because it's undisputed that there is no, you know, ongoing negligent contemporaneous activity. Ranger wasn't at the site on the date of this accident. And then the gross negligence claim is a fourth issue, I suppose.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that clarification.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's hear from the appellant in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have three brief points in rebuttal, and I actually want to start with the very end with your question, Justice Crump, which is what should the proper focus of the court here be? For us, I think that question is clear. The proper focus is duty. And I think Ranger acknowledges as well when they say we have to determine whether this is an ordinary negligence case or a premises liability case, that determination turns on what the nature of Ranger's duty was. And the nature of Ranger's duty for its premises liability circumstances turns on whether it actually owned or controlled the premises at the time of the injury. So that's my first point. My second point, I want to talk about United Scaffolding, because I agree with my friend on the other side. The court does analyze the injury question first before it gets to the control question, and so I can see how that would create the impression that that's the way the analysis is supposed to proceed. But it's important to consider the context of that opinion with the opinion below. What the Court of Appeals found in United Scaffolding was that the plaintiff could bring an ordinary negligence claim even though the defendant also controlled the premises. And what the Supreme Court said in United Scaffolding is that's not how this works. If the defendant controls the premises, the way we determine whether there's an ordinary negligence claim is we have to look at the nature of the injury. But if there is no otherwise ownership or control over the premises, we don't have to conduct this injury inquiry because there's no accompanying duty. And so it was in response to the Court of Appeals' erroneous conclusion, according to the Supreme Court, that a ordinary negligence could not be brought against an independent contractor who controlled the premises. That leads to the structure of the opinion. And I think the way we know that the court in United Scaffolding thinks that the control question is first comes near the end and actually in the dissent. So it's Justice Griffin, I think, that dissents saying, you know, what we have done here, he accuses the majority of effectively turning a duty question into an injury question. He says what the majority has done here is it has forsaken this idea that we look at control first, and it says, no, actually the first thing we do is we look at the injury. And the majority responds in the last paragraph of its section on that question, and it says the dissent accuses us of kind of working this sea change in law. That's not what we're doing. Our holding is limited to a conclusion that the dissent does not disagree with, which is when an independent contractor has control over the premises, its liability sounds exclusively in premises liability. But that's not this case, because Ranger has declaimed over and over again that it did not have control over the premises at the time of the injury. The third thing is kind of a general note, and I think that there's been some kind of analytical difficulty. Justice Crump asking about is this, or maybe it was Justice Ellis, I'm sorry, about what is this a question of law or is this a question of fact? What does the nature of duty look like? Is this open and obvious? I think the problem generating this kind of analytical tension is that we are evaluating an ordinary negligence case under premises liability principles. If we look at this as an ordinary negligence case, we don't worry about any of those issues because this is properly an ordinary negligence case. This is not properly a premises liability case. And I think ultimately what Mr. Smith is asking this court to do is to take Ranger at its word and to ensure that in these circumstances, a plaintiff has an either or option and not a neither nor option. We believe that the judgment below should be reversed.
Thank you. Thank you, counsels. We appreciate the presentation of this case, and this case will be submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you very much.